begin from going to the mosque.
Okay.
So the greatest responsibility will rest on the shoulders of the parents now to groom this child enough to feel like going to the mosque. Right?
Very true. Yes, and inshallah that this is implemented. So we're just going to take a short break and inshallah we will continue this discussion. Please stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to your audience to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. And this is Islamic Upbringing. So we were talking about how children are our future leaders and that it is so important for us to bringing them up from when they're young, because they're going to be our leaders and effective members of the society. So you say that we want a strong community and our youth will have to face the government and tackle them rightly. So they have to be brought up in a way that they'll be able to serve their, you know, country and their communities, because those countries are not going to always be Islamic. So how are they going to live in these kind of environments? And so it's so important for us to, you know, bring them up and like make their foundation strong.
So this is a very great responsibility, of course, on the parents to groom such children properly.
Yeah.
And it begins by encouraging them to go to the mosque. This is this very small social surrounding. The home is, of course, the smallest social surrounding.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, in the time that this virus is going on, the COVID-19 virus, you know, we encourage to make festivals and mourning ceremonies even right at our home, right? Because the home is a social place to develop now that we can't go to the mosques. And some areas, of course, the mosques are open.
Yeah.
So it is upon the mother and father to have this incentive to send the children to the mosque. And however small they are, if the parents can go with the children to the mosque, that's a wonderful thing. To get this good feeling of how one feels when they go to the mosque.
To inculcate it into them from a young age.
From a very young age. And it's so good that even if you take your small child to the mosque with some toys and he hears the adhan going on and people praying in congregation and then, you know, tea being served.
Yeah.
He feels a very happiness, although he has everything at home. But he feels the change of the surrounding and the spirituality, right?
I think we see this a lot over here in Iran because we have the haram, alhamdulillah.
Yeah.
And so when we see parents bringing children from a young age to the haram, you'll see that till now, children on their own, they feel like they want to go to the haram. Like there is something that's pulling them.
Of course.
Don't even need to be forced.
Yes, of course. And that's magic of spirituality.
Yeah.
The magic of how children are attracted to spirituality because of their pure fitrats.
SubhanAllah,
so this is very important to inculcate that notion of the social, world out there. That how this small body is acting in such a way that the community, there's, you know, like a unity factor, togetherness, happiness, doing things for people, finding out about their problems. Then you get the spirit, this is not enough. You have to go further and further and further until you get the world people, all an Islamic organization working to bring the society for the advent of Imam Mahdi.
So
because you want leaders, remember?
Yeah.
The question was to bring leaders, and that's our aim, of course.
Definitely.
Right?
So it's not like you feel like you did a bit and you did your job, that's it. You know.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's continuous,
even at home, it's not like as if you did your job of being honest, trustworthy. Now what? Okay, you've done everything. But that person will be secular.
Mm.
The person will work for themselves. We don't want that. We want that community spirit.
Definitely.
We want that person to become, our children to become leaders, right?
Yeah, that's a very interesting discussion. And we're just going to stop for a short break. Please, dear audience, stay tuned.
The Prophet ﷺ said, honor your children, teach them good manners.
Welcome back, dear audience, on IRIB English Radio broadcasting from Iran. The show is Islamic Upbringing with our dear sister, Sister Salma Khalfan. Sister Salma, we were discussing on how we can make our children effective youths and members of the society tomorrow. And you say that, you know, we want to bring them up in a way that they will be able to serve their communities in the right way. And you said at least we should start by encouraging them to go to the mosque, even encouraging them us to have programs at home now that the situation of COVID is like this. So what other platforms are there for us to bring up our children and make them, you know, able to serve their community better?
Okay. So the foundation for the political and sociological training has to be laid in childhood of a person beginning at a very tender age. And that's how I said that take them to the mosques for them to taste this, you know, this togetherness,
yeah,
this feeling of community spirit, right?
Very true.
But by the time a child reaches the age of youth, he should be now aware of the social and political problems of the community in which he lives. Yes, yeah. Even the Quran mentions that, you know, أَقَامُ الصَّلَاةُ وَآتُ الزَّكَاةُ. That means, you know, keep up prayer and then also be with the people. Now find out about their problems also. Give them that sadaqah. And find out about the problems of the community. Are they experiencing backwardness in ilm, for example, knowledge? Are they experiencing some kind of poverty, some kind of psychological problem that they have? And that's why there's a very good tradition that says that search for your friends in the mosque, okay?
Yeah.
So the good qualities and the failings of the rulers of the day have to be informed to the children who are like reaching youth age.
Right.
And that I can say is about maybe 10, tender age of 10, they can understand what's going on now.
Okay, yeah.
What is your country going through? Why are people crying out so much? Why is there so much poverty and downtrodden places? Why some people are living so nicely and some people are living poverty? Well, there's one Lord. But that Lord, that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, expects what? Expects us to do our duty. He has given us the resources. Maybe the rich are supposed to be given to the poor. And everything has been laid out for us.
Very true.
Rules have been laid out.
Yeah.
In jurisprudence, for example, Homs, the text that we have to, you know, take out, the yearly tax.
Yes.
Which is only a tenth of the wealth. 20%. It's nothing. Only people make it a big deal out of it.
Yeah.
Right?
That's very true. And I feel like sometimes it just gets difficult for people to let go of these small things. But
yeah.
I feel like if we work with our children from a young age, this is going to occur naturally for the child when they grow up, inshallah.
Also, you know, like the general conditions of people living in towns and the countries.
Yeah.
How are they living? For example, now that we know which part of the world is suffering. You know, Yemen is suffering, Kashmir is suffering, Bangladesh is suffering. All these people are so downtrodden. What duty do we have? This is like ingraining the community spirit now.
Yeah.
That people who are near us are the people who we go to and see as, you know, the people who we have gathered with, the mosques, the congregational prayer. But what about people who are living far from us?
Yes, it's definitely something we should try and think about and even work on. And inshallah that we try and bring up our children to be effective members of the society. Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have. Dear audience, thank you for joining us on the program. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email englishradio@irib.ir and visit us at our website parstoday.com. Inshallah, till the next episode, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Inshallah.
Around the world with reporters.
capital, Sana'a, hosted the first scientific conference on cancerous diseases with a focus on gynecological cancers, attended by a large number of specialized doctors and academics under the sponsorship of the Yemeni Health Ministry.
We thought about enhancing the role of person, individual roles, families, communities, to be like sharing us our concern about their health by educating them, by raise awareness about the signs and symptoms of cancers.
Since 2015, the number of cancer cases in Yemen has increased rapidly. According to the Undersecretary of the Health Ministry, Ali Jahaf, he says this is due to the prohibited arms used by the U.S.-Saudi coalition over the past years.
That they have used forbidden armaments in bombing Yemen.
Yemeni army says it has discovered large quantities of U.S.-built munitions at the positions of Saudi mercenaries while conducting clean-up operations in the provinces of Marib and Al-Bayda. Saudi Arabia and a number of its regional allies launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015 in order to bring for Riyadh friendly President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi back to power. Riyadh is the largest buyer of American-made weaponry. Trump signed an arms deal worth $110 billion with Saudi Arabia in May 2017. The Saudi military aggression against Yemen, coupled with a naval blockade, has killed hundreds of thousands of people and plunged Yemen into what UN says the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Military camps have been set up to help overwhelmed reception facilities, but local authorities say the government is not doing enough. The island's president, Antonio Morales, has denounced what he calls the Ministry of Interior's continued contempt for migrants and the island, demanding the resignation of those responsible. Driven by economic hardship, around 17,000 migrants have arrived on the Canary Islands this year. According to Spain's Interior Ministry, that's a 1,000% increase from 2019. In 2019, 1,885 migrants drowned in the Mediterranean Sea, and 2020's death toll is fast approaching 1,000. Only last week, the Spanish Open Arms NGO reported six deaths after releasing this harrowing footage. Open Arms, the only NGO permitted to carry out search and rescue missions at present, wrote on Twitter, "Despite the enormous commitment of our medical team, a six-month-old baby has just died. We requested an urgent evacuation for him and other people in serious conditions, but he didn't make it. How much pain and sorrow." The International Criminal Court has sued the European Union, saying member states should be prosecuted for the deaths of thousands of migrants who have drowned in the Mediterranean. In its 245-page document, the ICC says the EU's deterrence-based migration policy, which came into force after 2014, sacrifices the lives of migrants in distress at sea to dissuade others from seeking a safe haven in Europe. Bianca Rahimi, London.
As the G20 summit is about to kick off in Saudi Arabia, Amnesty International is calling on the attendees of the meeting to take the kingdom to task for its appalling human rights record. The Crown had planned to promote its contentious reform agenda to the world and show Saudi Arabia is open for business. However, Riyadh summit will be solely held in the form of a virtual meeting due to the coronavirus restrictions. Amnesty International is urging G20 leaders to join the call for the immediate release of a number of jailed women's rights activists arrested in 2018.
What we said on the eve of the G20 is that Saudi Arabia's real change makers, the activists who spearheaded campaigns for women's rights, are in jail or facing trial. Riyadh is an inappropriate host.
Since assuming the G20 presidency in December last year, Riyadh has publicized new initiatives on women's employment opportunities, claiming that the kingdom is strongly committed to empowering women and girls.
On the occasion of the G20 summit, the Embassy of Saudi Arabia in Italy has organized a webinar on females' inclusion in society. Human rights groups have slammed these initiatives as mere attempts to reshape the kingdom's image through expensive PR campaigns, presenting Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman as a reformer.
The Crown has spent billions of dollars hosting major political, entertainment, cultural and sporting events as a deliberate strategy to deflect from the country's image as a pervasive human rights violator, to whitewash its dismal rights record.
Saudi Arabia is using the G20 meeting in Riyadh to build legitimacy. Bear in mind that bin Salman is behind the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi and the Yemen war. The kingdom is cashing in on Donald Trump's staunch support all along the way.
Saudi Arabia is the first Arab nation to host the G20 summit. The meeting of the leaders of the world's most industrialized countries and emerging economies will be held on November 21st and 22nd. Max Civili, Rome.
A high-level conference focusing on the EU's treatment of refugees has just concluded in the European Parliament, Brussels. During the event, the 27-nation bloc's migration and asylum policy was slated. It appears a new crisis is emerging at sea as desperate African refugees try to reach EU territory.
Look what is already happening in the Atlantic. Hundreds of people are trying to reach the Canary Islands. Through the Atlantic, one of the most perilous routes in the world, they are dying there.
The EU unveiled a new asylum policy in September, but critics say the focus is on closing the bloc's borders instead of respecting international law and upholding the EU's much trumpeted values.
Our staff has spoken out against policies which are directly responsible for this unimaginable human suffering. Time and again, European nations and institutions have failed to act on their duty.
Many organizations insist the EU should be viewing immigration as an opportunity rather than a threat.
Behind all those people, there are hidden skills. We need to identify those skills and to use those skills in our European labor market.
The EU is paying billions of euro to Turkey and several African nations to try and prevent refugees from traveling. During the Brussels event, Ankara was accused of using the refugee crisis to advance geopolitical goals.
It is wrong to endorse the popular view of Turkey as a victim of the war in Syria. Turkey is on war in Syria since its very last start.
However, Ankara is highly critical of the European Union over its handling of the problem. Refugees continue to die in the Mediterranean. Those who make it are held in very poor conditions on Greek islands and now Spanish islands too.
Perhaps the most compelling argument being made by rights groups for the EU to do more is because the West has fueled so much conflict in the Middle East and Africa, effectively playing a big role in helping to create the refugee crisis. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
There are claims of discrimination at this school that highlighted the entrenched racism which resides in the broader community here. Among the accounts, children of colour were described with highly derogatory terms by teachers and fellow learners who were excluded from certain activities. And when this was protested, white individuals from the area violently attacked those raising concerns. Protesters say by perpetuating this attitude, which is reminiscent of the apartheid years, youth born under South Africa's democracy are still being taught old racial tendencies.
That we are against the racism. We are not against the white people. You must be correct with that. We are not against with white people. They are humans like us. But the way they treat us, it's like we are not humans.
But today, as before, the police were clearly set to protect the white community, blocking all efforts by the protesters to make progress. Demonstrators point to a broader issue with how the government continues to target the vulnerable.
It was just a peaceful protest because no one did anything to harm the police. We were just peacefully and then raising our voices that enough is enough. So they started to do this thing. Because we are black.
This is an illusion of democracy that we are getting. It's just a democracy that we have received just only to vote. But in terms of freedom, we are not free.
Scenes of a riot that we have witnessed here in this area today. Stun grenades, rubber bullets, as well as water cannons used to disperse the crowd. And so they were prevented from handing over their memorandum of demands, which of course was against racism within this area. At this point, there appears little effort by authorities to make a move against racism here. The Provincial Education Department has rejected calls by the South African Human Rights Commission for a probe or any action against teachers accused of racism. The opposition left-leaning economic freedom fighters, which has led these protests, say it is this attitude that will only ensure they continue with their protests. Hassan Siriop, Cape Town.
Both mainstream parties in the United States have been profoundly shaken by the election results from November 3rd. While the Democrats may prevail in the still-disputed presidential election, their so-called blue wave has been universally described as an abject disaster. Despite unprecedented mainstream media support, widespread leftist-based protests, and record fundraising, they failed to retake the Senate, lost seats in the House, lost one governorship, and failed to flip a single state legislature. Because this is a census year, Republicans will control drawing up most of the decade's new electoral maps, causing many to say the election was a disastrous setback for progressive causes.
70% of Republicans, 90% of Democratic voters are for Medicare for All. They're for the ending of student debt. They're for a UBI to sustain them, especially during COVID. So these things are very progressive, and the Democrats were against them.
Massive infighting among the party elite is being reported. Older and moderate Democrats blame newly popular progressive causes for the losses, but the Democratic Socialists of America, the left wing of the Democratic Party, won 70% of the races and ballot initiatives they endorsed.
The Democrats really aren't progressive. I would attribute their losses to putting up bad candidates, candidates that are very centrist. So this is the strategy of the Democrats, is we need to be more centrist or more rightist centrist, and they'll blame progressives.
The election results were widely expected to be a repudiation of so-called Trumpism, but analysts say they actually cemented the unprecedented political uprising unexpectedly led by Donald Trump. So-called Trumpian Republicans are now expected to reshape the Conservative Party. There seems to be unanimous agreement that regardless of the final outcome of the presidential election, Trump and his family will have increased, not decreased, control over the Republican Party. A pre-election poll asked Republicans and Republican-leaning independents if they considered themselves a supporter of Trump or a supporter of the Republican Party. 60% picked Trump.
Whichever presidential candidate is finally inaugurated, it seems certain that America has undergone a dramatic political shift, which few people predicted and which many are struggling to understand and accept. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Sheikh Zazaki's trial continued in a Kaduna State High Court in northern Nigeria with the presentation of two prosecution witnesses. The two witnesses were officers of the Nigerian Army who made their presentations in court while journalists stay outside.
They gave evidence about the operation, of the military operation that lasted between the 12th and the 14th of December 2015, and the role played by each of them. We just want to see how far we can go tomorrow. The prosecution is not likely to close the case tomorrow. So we'll then take all that day so that we can speedily, have this matter concluded.
Sheikh Ibrahim Zazaki is being tried for culpable homicide, unlawful assembly, disruption of public peace, among other allegations, which the Islamic movement has described as fabricated and baseless. In December 2015, soldiers of the Nigerian Army attacked Zazaki's home and worship center killing over 340 of his supporters. No soldier has been charged for the mass murders of Zazaki's supporters, despite the recommendation of a judicial commission of inquiry set up by the Kaduna state government. Sheikh Zazaki has been in detention for close to 5 years in violation of the ruling of a federal high court ordering for his release.
The Nigerian judiciary is a very independent judiciary. So by the grace of Allah, there is going to be a way out for Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki, in as much as the Nigerian judiciary remain independent. Definitely there is going to be a way out for Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki through the constitutional means.
Despite being a public trial, no journalist or any member of the Zazaki family has ever been allowed inside the courtroom. Meanwhile, Zazaki supporters have continued to demand for his release in accordance with the order of a federal high court in Abuja. Tanjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
Former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden has been projected the winner in the disputed U.S. presidential vote. That means in about 2 months, Donald Trump will have to hand in power to Biden. His administration, however, is using every opportunity to take controversial steps. On Thursday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo paid a visit to an Israeli settlement in the occupied West Bank to further consolidate Israel's occupation of Palestinian lands.
During the Trump administration, America stands with Israel like never before. Indeed, the commitment we've made, the ironclad commitment we've made to the Jewish state, will continue.
Pompeo said the U.S. will label the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign as anti-Semitic and cancerous. He said Washington will require that imports from Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank be labeled as made in Israel. In 2016, the United Nations Security Council adopted a resolution to reaffirm the illegality of Israeli settlements. Referring to Israelis as an occupying power, the resolution called on Israel to stop settlement constructions and abide by its obligations under international law. Later in the day, Mike Pompeo also visited the occupied Golan Heights, which Israel seized from Syria in a 1967 war. President Trump recognized Israel's sovereignty over the region last year. Pompeo's Thursday visits drew the ire of the Palestinians. A spokesman for Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas slammed the U.S. labeling move as a violation of international law. Also, senior member of the Palestine Liberation Organization, Wassel Abu Youssef, said Pompeo's labeling announcement, quote, reaffirms the partnership between U.S. President Trump and the occupation. Another senior PLO member, Hanan Ashrawi, said Mike Pompeo's visit is aimed at setting another illegal precedent. Pompeo's visits to an Israeli settlement and the occupied Golan Heights were controversial enough. However, they are dwarfed by other anti-Palestinian moves taken by the Trump administration in the past 4 years. Trump announced Jerusalem Al-Quds as the capital of Israel. Palestinians say the city belongs to them and is the capital of their state. Trump also relocated the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Al-Quds. The American president also showed unprecedented support for Israeli crimes, including bombardment of the Gaza Strip and killing of Palestinians across the occupied territories, setting new precedents in Washington's deep-seated and biased support for the Israeli occupation and crimes against Palestinians.
Millions of businesses across the EU's 27 member states remain closed due to COVID-19. Retail, hospitality, and aviation sectors have been decimated by the pandemic.
People who never were really in the risk of poverty are now really at the risk of poverty. They are now queuing up for food aid.
The European Commission has just published its EU Economic Semester Report 2021, and things are not looking good.
We will have an incomplete and uneven recovery over the coming 2 years, and with persistent uncertainty and multiple risks.
The Commission's report highlights how a debt mountain is growing in the EU, particularly in key nations such as Italy and France. Lobby groups are questioning whether financial support packages already announced will be sufficient.
Is it going to start a new growth for Europe and employment for Europe? We are not sure either. So it's a lot of promise. They have to deliver, because otherwise people will be so disappointed and the trust will completely disappear.
The EU is experiencing its sharpest ever decline in employment due to the pandemic, and things were certainly not perfect even before COVID-19. The European Commission says political leaders across the bloc must take decisive action to prevent social catastrophe.
We need a quick agreement on all elements of EU's €1.82 trillion recovery package to support the real economy. People and businesses are waiting.
The EU Commission says 4.1 million temporary jobs have been lost in the bloc. Young adults have been impacted most severely.
Suicide rates in the EU are on the up. Therefore, social rights groups say the need for governments to agree on financial support is not just about the economy. It is, in fact, a matter of life and death. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Coronavirus infections among the general population are rapidly rising in the Gaza Strip, with nearly 500 cases being discovered on a daily basis. On Wednesday, 4 deaths were reported and 600 infections were detected, bringing the number of infections to over 12,000. Hospitals in Gaza, meanwhile, are running low on intensive care units and ventilators, as well as medicines and equipment. During a press conference, the Ministry of Interior in Gaza raised the alarm over the rising number of infections.
The Ministry of Interior may be forced to take some extreme and tough measures, including a full lockdown given the high number of daily infections. Today, the rate of infections has increased more than 20% compared with only 5% during the first weeks of the spread of the deadly virus.
Due to the Israeli blockade, nearly 2 million Gazans are under terrible strain, and their worries over the coronavirus have been heavily compounded.
The rapid rise in the number of infections is frightening. Given the current circumstances, we are praying for a miracle to keep us safe during this deadly pandemic.
The blockade has destroyed our economy, and a full lockdown will be catastrophic. I think a partial lockdown is better so that people can make a living amid the dire economic situation.
The coronavirus spread among the general population has taken its toll on the impoverished coastal sliver. A full lockdown was imposed on the Gaza Strip in late August for a period of 2 weeks after authorities confirmed the first coronavirus cases spread through the community.
During the full lockdown, factories and businesses were completely closed, inflicting a heavy blow on the economic sector of the enclave, which has been battered by the Israeli blockade. All institutions, including civil society organizations, are suffering from lack of funding as poverty and unemployment rates increasing rapidly.
The coronavirus continues to threaten the socioeconomic welfare of Palestinians living in Gaza as much as their health.
People here are bracing themselves for the worst as coronavirus infections continue to increase at a fast pace amid the crippling Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
A new U.S. government study shows how some of the U.S. largest and most profitable corporations, including Walmart, McDonald's, Dollar General, and Amazon, feast upon taxpayer money by paying their employees such low wages that huge numbers of those workers throughout the year are forced to rely on public assistance programs such as Medicaid and food assistance just to keep themselves and their families afloat. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by John Quilly Ryder. This article is published under the heading GAO Study Shows How American Taxpayers Subsidize Starvation Wages of U.S. Corporate Giants. Here's the details of this article. Pinpointing a reality denounced as morally obscene by Senator Bernie Sanders, a new government study shows how some of the U.S. largest and most profitable corporations, including Walmart, McDonald's, Dollar General, and Amazon, feast upon taxpayer money by paying their employees such low wages that huge numbers of those workers throughout the year are forced to rely on public assistance programs such as Medicaid and food assistance just to keep themselves and their families afloat. According to a statement from Sanders' office, the study he commissioned the Government Accountability Office to carry out, titled Millions of Full-Time Workers Rely on Federal Health Care and Food Assistance Programs, found that an estimated 5.7 million Medicaid enrollees and 4.7 million SNAP, that is Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Programs, recipients who worked full-time for 50 or more weeks in 2018 earned wages so low that they qualified for these federal benefits. In addition, an estimated 12 million wage-earning adults enrolled in Medicaid and 9 million wage-earning adults living in households receiving SNAP benefits worked at some point in 2018. Upon the study's release on Wednesday, November 18th, Warren Gunnels, staff director and policy advisor for Senator Bernie Sanders, tweeted, "The real looting in America is the Walton family becoming $63 billion richer during a pandemic, while paying wages so low that 14,541 of their workers in 9 states need food stamps, all subsidized by U.S. taxpayers. Yes, the Walton family is the real welfare queen in America." According to the Washington Post, based on the GAO report, Walmart was one of the top 4 employers of SNAP and Medicaid beneficiaries in every state. McDonald's was in top 5 of employers with employees receiving federal benefits in at least 9 states. In the 9 states that responded about SNAP benefits, Arkansas, Georgia, Indiana, Maine, Massachusetts, Nebraska, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Washington, Walmart was found to have employed about 14,500 workers receiving the benefit, followed by McDonald's with 8,780, according to Sanders' team. In 6 states that reported Medicaid enrollees, Walmart again topped the list with 10,350 employees, followed by McDonald's with 4,600. In Georgia, for example, Walmart employed an estimated 3,959 workers on Medicaid. An estimated 2.1% of the total non-elderly, non-disabled people in the state receiving the benefit. McDonald's was next on the list, employing 1,480 who received Medicaid or 0.8% of the total of non-elderly, non-disabled people on the program. At a time when huge corporations like Walmart and McDonald's are making billions in profits and giving their CEOs tens of millions of dollars a year, they're reliant on corporate welfare from federal governments by paying their workers starvation wages, said Sanders in a statement. That is morally obscene. With the individual wealth of high-ranking executives and members of billionaire families like the Waltons, who own Walmart, soaring even as frontline minimum wage employees and their families struggling to stay afloat amid the devastating COVID-19 pandemic, Sanders argues that the stark contrast should be a wake-up call for those who have refused to see how unjust and economically backward it is for the federal government, meaning taxpayers, to subsidize the cruel wages that massive profitable companies force the workers to accept. U.S. taxpayers should not be forced to subsidize some of the largest and most profitable corporations in America, said Sanders. It is time for the owners of Walmart, McDonald's, and their large corporations to get off of welfare and pay their workers a living wage. No one in the U.S. should live in poverty, Sanders added. No one should go hungry. No one should be unable to get the medical care they need. It is long past time to increase the federal minimum wage from a starvation wage of $7.25 an hour to $15 and guarantee health care to all Americans as a human right, he added.
As everyone now recognizes, media polling was election interference in the truest sense of that word by powerful special interests. These really phony polls, I have to call them phony polls, fake polls, were designed to keep our voters at home, create the illusion of momentum for Mr. Biden, and diminish Republicans' ability to raise funds. They were what's called suppression polls. Everyone knows that now. And it's never been used to the extent that it's been used on this last election.
Who are the mainstream media? CNN, The New York Times, Washington Post, BBC, NBC, NPR, BBC ABC, and Fox News, among dozens of others. For years, it has been claimed that the mainstream media has been influenced by special interest groups and corporations. In fact, according to the U.S.-based Business Insider, six companies including GE, News Corp, Disney, Viacom, Time Warner, and CBS control 90% of the media.
So the story in the New York Times is a total fake. It's a fake newspaper, and they write fake stories.
It should be very clear that this is not in defense of Trump. It's not every day that a president of an economic and military powerhouse comes out and exposes what many have already suspected. Thus, it seems that the mainstream media has been at it for a while, and Trump is the highest level of power that has flagged them. In 2009, when Iran was having its presidential election, and when Mir Hossein Mousavi falsely declared himself winner before official results were given, some of these very same entities that Trump accuses of falsely calling the winner of the 2020 U.S. presidential election also sided with Mir Hossein Mousavi before getting all the facts straight. This, the media began a vilification of Iran while hiring spies to work for them inside of Iran and to instigate tensions there during the elections at least. In this recent U.S. election, networks like BBC congratulated Biden while calling Trump a liar and siding with those networks that do, while back in 2009, it used BBC Persian to explicitly try to create fake news. Sounds familiar?
It's really, I hope I came up with the term, but it is fake news. It's more than fake news. It's corrupt news. They write stories without calling anybody. They write a story today. I had a couple of stories where they never call me, ever, that I know of. At least nobody tells me. They'll write a story about me without even asking my opinion on something. It's totally fake.
Only in 2009, the target was Iran, but now it's one of their own, Trump. He's accusing them of being a small, powerful few that have large sway on everything you can think of.
People know what's happening, and they see what's happening, and it's before their eyes. And there are many instances which will be reported very shortly. There's tremendous litigation going on, and this is a case where they're trying to steal an election. They're trying to rig an election, and we can't let that happen.
This while the same entity over a decade ago disputed the election in Iran and supported rioters who were unhappy with the outcome. But in Trump's case, the mainstream media is vilifying Trump's supporters and Trump while backing Biden and his team. In Iran's case, the media was targeting the establishment pushing the people over the edge, and the alibi was that Iran was building nuclear weapons, while in Trump's case, it was another American civil war packed by fake news.
For you, Nora, let's start with the first one. The President Trump said it will go away, referring to coronavirus. We're rounding the corner. It's going away. We rate that as false.
American media even countered what it called 20,000 false or misleading claims.
Has now made more than 20,000 misleading or false statements.
Things have got fiery, too. He even left CBS 60 Minutes interview and more.
I think we have enough of an interview here. Okay, that's enough. Let's go. Let's go meet for 2 seconds, okay? All right. Thanks.
The president is wrong.
In addition to the lies that Brian just singled out there, and kudos to him for doing so quickly.
Yeah, Donald, President Trump here is just being ridiculous.
And partly because Donald Trump and Rudy Giuliani and the rest of Trump's cronies think it's a good idea to make the election a referendum on corruption.
China doesn't want to.
It's a bird! It's a plane! It's a crazy guy jacked up on steroids!
Even Twitter started flagging Trump's posts by labeling Trump's tweets as disputed and unprecedented move towards the person with the highest office in the U.S. What a spectacle! That was the reaction of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The leader said, "One says this is the most fraudulent election in U.S. history. Who says that? The president who is currently in office. His rival says Trump intends to rig the election. This is how U.S. elections and U.S. democracy are." Surprisingly, that tweet wasn't flagged, judging by the U.S. media's hostility towards Iran. Back in 2009, it was the media and the U.S. regime that were hand-in-hand stirring unrest in the Islamic Republic.
Along with the rest of the international community, the United States is closely watching events unfolding in Iran. We are deeply troubled by the reports of violence, arrests, and possible voting irregularities.
But it didn't end there. Just a few days later that year, Iranian security authorities discovered a foreign-linked terrorist plot to plant bombs in mosques and other crowded places in Tehran during the country's June 12 election. Unlike in the U.S. election, as according to claims of fraud and cheating from President Trump, Iran's government in 2009 explicitly stated that there was no fraud.
Fortunately, we have witnessed no major irregularities during the country's recent presidential election, and therefore there is no reason to annul the election.
It didn't stop there. CNN interviewed Reza Pahlavi, the son of deposed Iranian King Mohammad Reza Pahlavi.
First of all, do you believe this was a free and fair election?
Absolutely not. Is there any evidence these protests are actually spreading? And if so, what do you expect the Iranian government will do about it?
So far, they seem to be controlled. It's unlikely that they will become a mass uprising unless the defeated candidate, Mousavi, calls people into the streets.
My own sense is that the vote appears to have been rigged.
Was this a fraud, a cushion for an Ahmadinejad victory, or did they outright steal the election? They just don't know the scale of it yet.
It took a what the new website Politico called a buffoon, Donald Trump, to expose interference of mainstream media in the affairs of others. Of course, mainstream media has interfered in the policies of former presidents like Barack Obama and George Bush as well, but no one exposed them as much as Trump did, according to Trump himself. According to Swiss policy research, largely unbeknownst to the general public, executives and top journalists of almost all major U.S. media outlets have long been members of the Influential Council on Foreign Relations, CFR. In a column entitled Ruling Class Journalist, former Washington Post senior editor and ombudsman Richard Harwood described the council and its members approvingly as the nearest thing we have to a ruling establishment in the United States. Perhaps this is why the American public remains largely distrustful of the mass media. According to the most recent Gallup poll, only 9% of Americans currently have a great deal of trust in the mass media. This while 30% say the fair amount of trust in the mainstream media. Whether it is by Western officials or what they consider as their enemies, Western mainstream media has been exposed. They've been exposed at the highest levels for having their own policies that may or may not align with the interests of the people they are representing or targeting.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.